It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 231, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, make a podcast with AI, the future of search, passkey resistance.
And we're back after, what was it, 2 weeks, two missed weeks? Sorry about that, everyone. But, you know, every once in a while, life rears its ugly head. The way we've prioritized things. When it comes to those kind of situations, life wins.
Yep.
So we have some fun stuff to talk about today. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I shared on, I think it was my Facebook page, was that I had discovered, I'd heard about something called Notebook LM.
Yeah.
And I know, Gary, you posted a video, at least to your patrons, about Notebook LM as well.
Yes,
I
haven't indeed,
looked at the video, but I know you're well aware of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the thing that just amazes the heck out of me, this is one of those situations where my comment was that I don't get blown away very often, but I got blown away. Mm-hmm. And all I really did for this, there'll be a link in the show notes. It's a link to YouTube because that's a very easy place to post some audio. And it's a podcast style recording, runs about 10 minutes, that was generated 100% by AI. And all I did to generate it was take one of my articles about how you're not too old to do for computing. For technology, I just copy pasted that article into a note, as they call it in Notebook LM, and said, okay, make me a podcast. And it did. It was just amazing how the virtual artificial hosts basically just ended up having a very, very, I'm reluctant to call it realistic, but it's pretty darn close, discussion about that article. My only criticism of this particular podcast episode, because when I did my copy paste, I included the byline. So it says, it's the title of the article, and then there's by Leo Notenboom, and then it goes into the content. The virtual podcast hosts spent an inordinate amount of time talking me up. And that made me uncomfortable enough that I would never do that again, right? Every article, if I ever do this again, I will take the byline out of whatever I post in there. But other than that, it was just amazing. So I'm kind of curious, since you have done a video on it, what your experience has been with it as well.
Yeah, I've got a lot to say about this, actually. It is kind of amazing. And the first time you use it, you're blown away. Because there's these two hosts, two audio voices, very realistic speaking voices, but what they're saying is generated by AI as well. And they have a conversation with each other that sounds like two podcasters talking. It's incredible because they definitely take information from the sources you give. And you can give them a bunch of documents, a bunch of online articles,
yep,
video transcripts, all sorts of things. And they will kind of put it all together. Like, just like if it was two real people given, like, here, these seven documents, read them, and I'll talk about them for, 15 minutes.
Right.
And they also grab from other sources as well. Like,
I have noticed that. I suspected that they were doing that, they were pulling in a little bit more than I had written.
I gave them first my two videos I did on macOS Sequoia, my, the big features video and my hidden secrets video. And I gave them that, and they were definitely talking. The way they mentioned a few things, it's like, oh, this goes not beyond the article or the videos in terms of the content, but just they knew a few things. Like, they behaved intelligently, like they were people that knew what macOS was and knew that people got excited about new features and stuff like that.
Right.
And I also gave them then a PDF that Apple provides that lists all of the new features, and that kind of changed it a little bit. It was interesting. I tried it many times, like different variations of things, enough to start to get annoyed by these podcasters. It was like, it seemed to me that they wasted a lot of time talking about like stuff, but you know, that's what we do. That's what regular podcasters do. So I guess it's okay. I also started to like get tired of their voices. I
Yes.
think this is like a huge, really cool use, but it right now has no controls whatsoever. You give it sources and you press go. If it could have like, you know, given that there's two hosts, if you could pick from a list of seven hosts and then say these two, I mean, so there's a ton of combinations all of a sudden with different voices. And if you could pick like, I want this to be really brief, or I want this to go in detail, I want this level of banter, you know, just a bunch of controls like that, just to make it more interesting, you could really do cool things. In the video, I talk about using this of I try to think of regular uses for this. And like one thing that occurred to me is I know now in college a lot, you get a lot of articles for your class. Like textbooks aren't as big as they were when we went to college. A lot of times now you go to a class where there's no textbook and you're just fed tons of PDFs. You know, this article and this, you know, it could be a 30-page article, and then there could be like this 2-page article, and then there's this interview with somebody, and you know, all this material you've got, all stuff that you could definitely feed in here. And it would be fascinating that if you're in one of these classes to be able to feed all that stuff in, say the night before your midterm, and then say, make a podcast for me, and then be able to listen to that podcast on based on all the material that the midterm is going to be on as a as another way to study. Like when you run out of like, I've read the material, I've highlighted it all, I've taken notes, what else can I do? Oh, let me make this podcast, and then let me sit back and listen to these podcasters discuss it like it was just on a show today. You know, so that could be like another really cool use for it, even like for meeting briefings and stuff. Like, okay, we're gonna, oh, I'm going into a meeting at work. We're gonna be talking about these things. Let me grab these sources here, throw them into a podcast, and while I'm driving to work today, I will listen to it. Or you're heading to meet friends, and you know, oh boy, they're really gonna talk about this thing that's going on. I'm not up to speed on it, but I have 15 minutes while I walk over to meet them. Podcast. And you know, throw your sources in. So interesting stuff. I think it could be a hit as long as Google acts quickly and adds a bunch of controls to make it better than just this one button and you get these results and that's it.
Clearly, this is demonstration technology,
Oh
I'll call
yeah,
it,
and the
because there
past.
are zero controls, as you point
Oh
out,
yeah,
and
nothing. It's just
there,
the.
you could generate one kind of thing, a podcast with two speakers that you can't control, and so forth. But I think that it is a wonderful harbinger of things to come.
There is a bit of randomness in it because I was trying it multiple times. There's a male voice and a female voice. And I noticed that sometimes it would be one of them that would be the, oh, you've come in here with a bunch of these video transcripts. Well, tell us about what you discovered. And sometimes it was the other one that went and
Role
said that
reversal,
kind
yeah.
of thing. So there is they it is kind of like there's a setting in there that's just being randomly set now that could be like a manual setting. I also saw a hilarious little video. I saw it on TikTok of somebody using this, and they didn't name that it was Notebook LM, but it's obvious from anybody that's used it and you recognize the voices. They said it was AI realizing that it's AI. And what obviously somebody did, well, I'd say probably there's a good chance, like 50% chance it was faked somehow, and they just had him say whatever they wanted to say. But I think it could have actually been a regular Notebook LM thing where they fed it a few articles about Notebook LM in itself and how these are AI voices that are generating this. And the podcasters start to talk about how they're not real and how they start to get philosophical about it.
They have an existential crisis.
An existential crisis, you know, which to like people that don't know much about AI, the whole thing seemed very bizarre. And it's like, yeah, they're, yeah, I'm pretty sure that actually at least one of their sources is talking about the about AI and like AI realizing that it's AI or something like that. And they're just feeding off of it in kind of a loop. And it's all just, you know, garbage, really. But it does sound like two podcasters realizing, wait, we're not real. That kind of thing. So it's interesting, and it is interesting how self, like it like you said, it was talking you up because you mentioned the articles were for you. For me, it was mentioning how these were video transcripts that they had as sources. Oh yeah, so I was reading through these video transcripts, and I was like, why say that? Say I was watching a video, not I was reading through these video transcripts because you know. So yeah, there's a lot of that stuff that goes on. It talks about, like, I think if you fed it like a long PDF that was a book chapter, they would say, like, and you said, here's a book chapter. They would say, like, so I just got finishing reading this chapter of this book and blah, blah, blah. And then it would, it is interesting that it does that, which is kind of neat. So yeah, it's a cool tool. I've seen tools like this over the years that are cool when they first come out, and then the company fails to, like, move them forward quickly enough to make people happy. I think if it's still the same tool in 2 months, then it's dead on to the next thing. If they keep pushing it forward and give you controls and all sorts of cool stuff that you can do, then it could be it could have some legs.
Now, to be clear, this particular tool, this Generate a Podcast tool, it's a subset. In fact, it is literally just one feature of what Notebook LM is attempting to do. As I understand it, the whole concept of Notebook LM is that you basically dump a bunch of information into a quote unquote notebook. The AI processes it, and you can then ask it questions or have a discussion or do anything, whatever you would want to do to interact with the Notebook LM, to basically presumably enhance your understanding of all this stuff that you've just given it. The fact that they're doing this podcast, yep, that's one additional way to do it. But like I said, it's a feature of the product. It is not the product itself.
Right, and you could do that. You could have done that for the last year plus with other LLMs like ChatGPT. You could give it an article, like I did for my HOA document. It's like 60 pages, right, of legalese. I fed it in, and I thought this is the perfect, example. And I was able to ask questions about things, like what things can I have on my balcony. And it turns out there are many different sections that deal with that in many different ways using many different types of legal terms. It's not just like there was a section called things on your back, you can have on your balcony. It was all over the place, which is what prompted me to ask that question. And I was able to ask questions and, get answers without having to read through or find stuff in there. And you could do that with ChatGPT. This is kind of like Google realizing, hey, people who are not using AI, it's because it's this whole chat thing, right? Chat doesn't have to be the interface. Here's another way to do it: a notebook. Feed stuff into a notebook, and now you can actually, it's like your own little intranet. You can search and ask questions, about things. You could have it summarized, you can have it make bullet lists, all these different things. And it's just a different way that I think some people for some tasks will find it much easier to deal with than the, linear chat
Here's the
format.
challenge. I think I've talked about this before. One of the things I really, really want is a GPT, a large language model that's been trained on Ask Leo content, all the articles that I've written. What would it look like if I took the content of all my articles, and it would be a bit of work to, get it into a proper format, and just dumped it into Notebook LM? Could I then start asking it questions about my own stuff? Because to be fair, in fact, I commented on this in another venue some just earlier this week. I have absolutely written the same article twice because I forgot I wrote it, right? So if instead, I had this corpus of information in a tool like Notebook LM or some other kind of a large language model, and could start probing it for the answers that I've already put together, that would be kind of interesting. It would also be interesting then to turn around and make that public rather than having a quote unquote search engine, search interface to the website, have a chat interface that, and we'll talk about this in a minute too, that did a good job of not only giving you an answer, but telling you where it got the answer from.
And there was a journalist in the last couple of weeks too that set up a chatbot for their, based on all their, past articles. And I can't
It's
remember.
certainly possible. It's not particularly easy right now. On the other hand, Notebook LM, I mean, if it literally is just, dump all your content into the LM and let it do its thing, that actually is pretty easy.
Yep, indeed. And this leads to another kind of topic off of this,
Yes.
is because I did post that video about using Notebook LM, and all my examples were very like personal, like actually using it as a notebook, studying for a test, educating yourself on some topic, that kind of thing. And I purposely avoided the whole idea of like you could take a couple things, make this podcast, and then post it as a podcast for everybody else to listen to, like you were a podcast publisher, right? I purposely avoided that because it's like, I don't think that's the use for this. The use for this is the format of podcast, but it's a personal podcast for you to listen to, not something to be published for others. And yet I still had at least one comment that jumped right to that conclusion and declared this to be another example of a bad use of AI, with the idea being that it's just, plagiarism or whatever. Somebody could take somebody else's work, make a podcast off of it, and publish it. And I felt a little sad about that response because I'm trying to present the positive thing here. And just to go directly to the negative, it's like maybe I felt I wasn't do quite doing my job in like trying to present these good uses for it. But it's kind of, there's a duality, I think, with a lot of this stuff. I mean, with the image generation stuff, with the video generation stuff, and all of that, no matter how many good uses there are for it, and no matter how many times people just are talking about just something, good they're using it for, people jump immediately to the negative uses. And really thinking about it, it's not like AI is the first thing or the only thing to have this duality. Like all tools do, right? Like plagiarism is not something that didn't exist a year ago, and now suddenly it does because there's AI. Plagiarism existed, continues to exist outside of AI, and it's, totally possible for you to do it. But nobody goes and say reads a textbook and takes notes, and then somebody says, "Oh, you're just going to publish those notes, aren't you? That's plagiarism." It's like, no, this is my class. I'm taking a class. I'm taking notes like every other student that's ever taken this class.
Oh, and let's also point out that it's not necessarily plagiarism. I mean, you and I are of an age to remember Cliff Notes, which is exactly what you just described, right? It's somebody taking notes on a publication and then publishing those notes as another publication. In college, we had individuals who sat in class and took notes and then turned around and published those notes
Because they were
for.
good note, yeah, the good note takers,
Yeah, well, they were good note takers, and they would, I mean, literally, this was like a small business, right? They were hiring people to do this. So, yeah.
it's disappointing, but the duality is everywhere. It's like, oh, you could ask an AI to give you a video clip that's generated of, something, and it's like immediately you can go to the, oh, you could impersonate a political figure, you can fake news events, all this stuff. It's like, or you could generate, most movies and most TV shows are fiction, right? Like the vast majority of it are fiction. I mean, there's a huge documentary film thing, but if you go by number of views, it's mostly fiction stuff. It's art. So when you generate, use an AI to generate a fictional scene, you were going to generate a fictional scene no matter what you did, whether you hired actors and had sets or did CGI that was manually created by artists. It hasn't changed the fact that it's fictional.
The argument
The
that I keep hearing, though, is
AI.
that we've trained AI on existing material, right? Somehow, AI has watched all the movies or read all the books or done whatever, and people consider that to be plagiarism. And I don't think it's quite that clear cut. I'm not saying it isn't a problem, but when you think about it, I write about technology. How do I know what I know? Well, I've read a lot. Is it plagiarism then when I use the knowledge that I've accumulated by reading to then turn around and write something on the same topic.
Yeah.
And I think the general attitude is, well, no, of course not. That's not plagiarism, unless, of course, you're quoting verbatim, which is. But when you think about it, AI is doing exactly the same thing.
Sure.
Just at a significantly more rapid pace.
If you've ever worked with artists in creative, like corporate stuff, you know, like I used to make lots of games, and I used to have artists that would draw the artwork for those games.
Right.
And rarely was that artwork ever drawn in a complete vacuum. I mean, occasionally we'd have like some bizarre game idea, and let's create a character in the game, and that just comes out of nowhere. But a lot of times it's like, we need a bat in the game to fly around. Well, the first thing the artist would do is like, what, how exactly do bats look like? You know, like their wings, I know they got webbing, and what, you know, bring it up, bring up some pictures, bring up some, here's some famous bats that have been in cartoons, that kind of thing. All this reference work, playing cards. Oh, we need a deck of playing cards. Oh, I'm going to lock you in a room. You can't look at any playing cards, and you have to create them from scratch. No, you look at a whole bunch of different decks of playing cards, and you start to say, oh, the King of Spades has these qualities in all the decks. Let me draw something that is kind of like that, that people would recognize as a King of Spades. And you know, you're always going off of that stuff. And that's what AI is doing. And certainly if AI ever crossed the line and made it completely plagiarized, they should, you know, whoever owns it, whoever, you know, made the AI do it, or, you know, has the copyright on it, should have the same consequences as if they hired an artist that did
right.
it. I also once hired, I had a website. This is a long time ago. This is probably 20 years, maybe 15 years ago. And I had this website that I had let sit idle for years. It was a great idea, and I was going to have a bunch of cool articles. It was a history site. And I just didn't get around to it. I complained to a friend about the fact that I just didn't have the time to write these articles on the subject. And they suggested hiring writers to do it. So I specifically did. I got somebody that would actually work as an editor and hire writers. And my number one thing was, like, no plagiarism. This has to be original work. But of course, I have to do research, right? And after they did that, and I got all these articles, and I put them up on the site, I noticed a couple of grammatical things. So I had somebody else outside of that say, yeah, I said, go through and look for the typos or look for the grammar mistakes. Just fix it up. And they started to, and they said, you know, I'm two articles in, and I've had to spell check people's names. And in doing so, I've already come across whole paragraphs of your stuff that was lifted from other sites.
Wow.
So even though it was my number one thing that I was trying to avoid, humans still plagiarized and gave me stuff I couldn't use. That was way before AI.
Sure.
AI would actually do a better job, because AI would probably not lift entire paragraphs.
Right.
They may or may not lift a couple words in a row or something like that, if a phrase kind of makes the most sense and it's used in a bunch of places. But I doubt it would just be pure plagiarism. At least if I had to choose now between an AI writing an article and a human writing an article, and you said you need to stake your life that there's no plagiarism in this, I sure would not choose the human.
Right.
Human would have a certain percentage of chance that they would plagiarize, whereas I think the AI wouldn't have any chance, because it would probably just specifically not be doing that.
It would probably be not as well written as a human, but now, nonetheless, it would be
or
original.
A chance of being as well written, I would say.
Right. And that's the thing that is going to improve over time. I mean, that much we know is that as AI matures, it's going to get better at that.
I know. And they're already specializing. Like, I've already heard from several people that Claude is great for writing.
Yeah.
And it's better than, it may not have all the answers, and it may not be able to explain things like ChatGPT does, or draw on as many data sources, but for actually crafting written word, Claude is better. So I know people that will ask ChatGPT for an explanation and then feed that into Claude to be rewritten. And that's how they get like really nicely written things. So, but I think there'll be specialization like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about doing that. Yeah. I know that there are differences. I regularly play with both ChatGPT and Claude and a couple of others. I keep coming back to ChatGPT for various reasons, but yeah.
Cool. All right.
So, So we're going to continue in this vein a little bit. Again, you and I have been around that we have seen the evolution of search. I remember that back in the day, it was, Yahoo had this directory that we were all scrambling to get into. And then that became AltaVista Search, where they actually had search results that were based on, better stuff than just being listed in a directory. And of course, Google came along and they did all sorts of different things to try and display the most reasonable content for whatever it is you are looking for, based on a number of criteria, obviously, that have changed over the years, as the spammers and others have come along to try and game the system. Whether or not Google is still at its peak, I don't think it is. I think the results haven't been as great lately, and there's a lot of complaint about the number of ads that are being shown in the search results. I did an article not that long ago about how I'm now using Kaji, Kagi.com, as a and I actually pay for it. That has no ads, does good results. I'm really happy with it. And if you're just looking for a plain decent search engine, that actually gives me some good results. However, I have found for what for me will probably be the next step in that path from Yahoo to AltaVista to Google to Perplexity.ai. I've started using it not just as a search engine. It's a fine search engine. It'll, find the things I want to find. It's more what Google was trying to be or is trying to be by providing answers. And the more I've thrown at it, the more impressed I've become. And when I say more, what I started doing with Perplexity is rather than, again, we've been doing the search engine thing for so long, we tend to think of keywords and phrases. If I want to look up a specific thing, I will think about what are the words that would give me that specific thing. Google has gotten better about inferring intent from the written, from writing a sentence. But ultimately, Perplexity, what I'm doing now is I am just writing full-on sentences that tell asks, what is, let's see, give me an example here. I did explain passkeys to me like I'm five, or well, I had one this afternoon. Where is the interior microphone in a Tesla Model S? Because I was doing something with the phone in my car, and I had no idea where the actual microphone is because it wasn't visible. Let's see. Oh, somebody asked me a question. So I've downloaded Revo Free and installer. However, the program I'm trying to delete does not show up in refreshing the installer list. What do I do here? I just copy pasted that into Perplexity and it gave me an answer. Step by step, things to look at, things to do. It was incredibly, incredibly impressive. Now, it's absolutely the case that it is not going to be 100% correct in all cases. But in terms of pointing me in a direction, it's been phenomenal. It's been really, really fascinating to play with. My canonical example that I actually took some screenshots for, and I'll see if I can't get those included in the show notes. I was playing with a project where I was essentially installing a large language model on my machine. I've got a local now. I now have a local large language model, so it's very private. It's fast. It's all happening on my machine. It's actually pretty cool. But in the process of doing so, I ran into what is, an error of some sort. And this is all Linux-based. So in true Linux fashion, the error is long, dense, complicated, and has lots of things I've never heard of. So, I wonder what happens if I just copy-paste this error message into Perplexity. And I did. That's all I did. I just took this very random collection of Linux-style error message. It was like 4 or 5 lines worth of stuff. And Perplexity came back and said, oh, Yeah, it looks like it's having problems finding this. Here are the steps you can try to fix it. It might be this, so do that. It might be this, so do that. It might be this, so do that. And indeed, it was the second one that it pointed me at that solved this particular problem. The fact that it was able to do that quickly, like within seconds, on just copy paste. I didn't even have a question. I just copy pasted the message, the error message into it. Was so incredibly useful that yeah, that's where I'm spending a lot of my time now when I'm doing searches or when I'm trying to get answers for things. Yep, I'm still using Kaji for, plain old searches where I know I've got a keyword and I need to find that or whatever. But when it comes to the more abstract things, which ultimately is what I think we are really thinking when we are searching, it basically eliminates the step of having to say, okay, here's what I'm looking for. What are the right keywords? Enter those keywords. Now we just say, okay, what am I looking for? Type that in somehow, and it comes up with answers. It's very, very impressive, and I'm going to be playing a lot with it.
Yeah, no, that's I've heard of it before, and it's interesting. I definitely find myself just going to AI in general more for answers than for search engines. I mean, it's disappointing that ChatGPT doesn't have, current stuff.
Right.
So having something like, that's more like a search engine. I think having something where you can get an answer if there's an answer and get links if there are links and not have to decide ahead of time which one you want. And a lot of people may not know what they want, right? Just because you know the question doesn't mean you know if the answer is better served by here's a web page or a video or here's a paragraph, of text. You may not know that. Or you may not want to devote the brain power to figuring that out. So having some search engine AI stuff is, I think, the future.
I mentioned earlier I was going to talk about citations, and this is the point where I was going to do that because one of the things that it's kind of hit and miss across some of the other AIs, but Perplexity is definitely, as part of its answers,
Yeah, I see that.
it's sprinkled with footnotes, and those footnotes reference links, which it collects, I think, at the bottom or something like that. And it gives you the opportunity to go investigate some more of the things that it found along the way. My only complaint is that I haven't seen my own website referenced as a source yet.
Oh, the only I just did a search for Perplexity for show me a what is a good source for video tutorials for Mac users.
Oh, cool.
And at first it said YouTube. Fair enough, right? And the second it said Mac most. And then it had the citation. And the citation was a Reddit post where Mac most where that question was asked and Mac most was mentioned twice. So that was nice.
Fascinating. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm going to have to ask it the right questions to get the answer I want.
Yeah. I guess that's a challenge is so try to get Perplexity to reference your own site. Like ask it a qu such a pointed question that you get yourself cited as a source.
One of the other things that I've done, and I think it was Perplexity that I did this with, is I just wanted to see if this would work. I said, okay, using only content from the site askleo.com, answer this question. And it didn't, which I thought was weird. But then I simply rephrased the question. Essentially, I flipped it around. Here's my question. Use only content from askleo.com to answer it. And poof, there it was. It did a fine job of, finding content from my site to answer the question. So again, what we were talking about earlier with Notebook LM, this is getting close to being able to say, yeah, this is how you ask questions of your own site.
And I can't wait for that to get closer to actually happening because I don't like being the intermediary between the information I've published and people asking questions. I like creating the content. And I like it when somebody asks something or discusses something, and that prompts me to make new content. What I
Yes.
don't like is when I made a video 4 months ago, somebody asked me a question, and I say, I have a video here, or maybe I just, say you do this, this, and this. I have more information in this video here. The thing is, it's then I realize, oh, I just spent several minutes being a search engine for
Yes.
that person. That's not good use of my time.
It
I'd rather have a search engine or, an AI
Right.
do that for me. Have somebody be able to ask that at my site, and then have that AI do that work for me. But yet, it's still my content. I'm still creating the content. I'm just not connecting the people to the right spot in the right video anymore.
It's funny because I've made the comment before that I am both a search engine for my own site and a translator for my own site. By
Oh,
that I
yeah.
mean, questions come in and they use whatever terminology they think is appropriate that is often not correct, or not correct in the sense that searching for that terminology won't get you the answer you really want, even though the answer is there. So a lot of what I do is translate what they've asked into what the site expects to get them the answer they're looking for.
Yeah, I need
And
not only
yes.
a. Oh, I was gonna say, not only do I need something for my site that where it's like a chatbot that works for Mac most that can answer questions. I need another one, or maybe a few of them that actually answer comments at YouTube,
Right.
for
Yes.
me. And the reason I need several of them is because I get several types of questions. Like one type will be an earnest question. Oh, I'm trying to do this for my Mac. How can I do this? And an answer to the person that needs help with something, or wants to know how to do something. The other thing is snide comments and remarks that have nothing really to do with me, but have to do with like, why did Apple do this, or why doesn't Apple do that? And I try to ignore them, but I would be great to have a chatbot that also worked for Mac most that would go on and just have the patience to explain to those people, why, oh, this is why it's hard to have software and operating systems, and yes, Windows has this and Mac doesn't. There are thousands of features that Mac has that Windows doesn't, and Windows has that Mac doesn't.
I've given up
That kind of thing.
trying to
Well,
deal with
that's why I want a
those
chatbot to
folks
do it.
specifically. Well, even then, I think a chat box wouldn't really accomplish a whole lot because what I find is that most of the people who are complaining in that manner
Yeah.
are not open to an explanation. They just want a vent, and that's fine. The ones that I and I you've probably seen this on my Facebook page. The ones that I do have a little fun with are the ones that try to insult me, or just make snide comments about what I've done. And I will give them a snarky answer, and then I will screen cap it and put it over on my Facebook page.
Yeah, I got to do more of
Because
that. I
it doesn't change them. It's not, it's not making
Yeah.
them feel any better, but it's entertaining the people who are paying attention. So.
Yeah. My favorite thing right now, and it's happening particularly right now because Apple just introduced macOS Sequoia, which has window tiling in it, which is a long requested feature of many Mac users, but has been part of Windows for a long time. And so that means people who have been complaining for many years that you can't do that on Mac without adding third-party apps now have a final round of being able to say that Apple finally is catching up with Windows. And my response, I try not to do this. I try to just ignore it. But every once in a while, I just have to respond. It's like, so do you think Apple should not have added this? Is my response. Should they not have added it? Because if your answer is no, they shouldn't have added it, well, why? You said this is useful, so they probably should have. And if you agree that they should have added it, well, they added it. So I don't understand what your comment is about.
Yeah.
It's an answer that doesn't have anything back from them. And the other thing is that people saying with the same window tiling feature, oh, now they're just copying Windows, they're not innovating. And my answer to that is, a lot of people have been asking for window tiling for years. Should Apple have ignored them?
And what
Simple.
else should they have done to
Yeah,
solve
should they
the
just have
problem?
ignored it? Innovation is great. You know what else is great? Is listening to users and what they want and providing them with those tools.
Imitation is the sincerest form of
Yeah.
flattery, and
I
it's been
mean,
worked both ways for decades.
yeah. What are you, in other words, the whole thing is, what are you complaining about exactly?
Yes.
Anyway.
They fixed my problem. Now I can't complain anymore. That's why I'm complaining. So anyway, that was, you know, like I said, there's so much going on in search right now. And I wanted to share the great experience I'm having with Perplexity. So.
Yeah, cool. I'm going to try using it a lot this week and see how it changes things for me. So this is an interesting topic. We probably I wish we had a tool where I could ask, what was the first time we said the word pass keys in this podcast? I'm going to guess it was probably 3 years ago,
Okay.
maybe longer. And pass keys became a big topic for a little while, because no more need for passwords. Matter of fact, that was what most headlines when pass keys were introduced, it said, passwords are going to be obsolete soon. We won't have to worry about passwords. Pass keys, going to replace them. So here we are, it's near the end of 2024, and have pass keys replaced passwords? No, not at all. They are around. People are using them. I'm using them for a few things, but they really haven't kind of destroyed passwords and taken over, despite some obvious advantages over passwords. And it kind of is, it's really interesting because I saw my first article, and I'll link to it here. There's a link in the notes. Because they have problems too. I mean, one of the things is that a lot of regular users just don't understand them, but they understand passwords, so they're going to stick with passwords. And as a, you know, somebody who advises people on security, I have a hard time telling somebody, hey, you understand passwords, great. You even understand you should have a random, unique, long password for different accounts. Now, even though you don't understand pass keys, you should switch to them. I have a hard time saying that, telling somebody to switch to a technology they don't understand when it's only really going to be fractionally better security-wise than what they've mastered already. That's like, I think one of the main reasons it hasn't spread very far is that another problem is there's tons of problems. Like, I have not to this day done a tutorial on pass keys. When they started, like the first couple companies introduced pass keys, I guess the first browsers announced support for pass keys. I put on my list of videos to do, pass keys. It's still sitting there on the list. I haven't done a video on it. One of the reasons is because the obvious way to do a video on it is to go to a site that supports passkeys and say, let's create a new user account. But instead of using a password, we're going to use a passkey. And then I'll show you how to be able to log on. However, I don't know if any sites actually do that still all these years later. You have to have an account first, and then you can generate a passkey.
Well, that's kind of how pass keys work.
Yes, which makes it so hard to demonstrate. Plus the fact that how you generate that passkey is different for
Sure.
just about every site. There is no stand, like a password, at least you can go and say, create a new account, enter your email address or ID, enter the password you want to use. And now there's some sites that will, you know, have a verification thing. But it's easy to understand. And you go to this other site and it's different colors and different fonts and all that, but it's the same thing. Passkeys, it's like, oh, okay, in this site you go to your settings and your accounts and security, and then there's a thing here and they call it verified security passkey, you know, and it's like, all right, so now I've taught you how to do it at whatever.com. That's not going to help you at any other site because it's going to be different. So it's been hard to explain. It's been hard to explain why it's better than passwords. And actually, it's only if you're using passwords correctly and intelligently, it's really hard to justify that passkeys are better. Most people still have problems with passwords using weak ones and falling for phishing attacks, things like that, in which case passkeys are so much better.
Yes.
But those are the exact people that are going to, if you're having trouble with passwords, jumping all the way to passkeys as the solution is a tough one. You know, it's like saying, oh, you need to get from point A to point B and you don't know how to ride a bike. Well, let me teach you how to drive a car. You know, it's like, maybe first, you know, learn how to ride a bike, that kind of thing.
I think the scenarios that are easiest to at least describe conceptually are those where, okay, this website doesn't use passwords, period. How do you sign in? How do you create a pass key? And I think that once you walk through that enough times, right, in enough different scenarios, then I think it starts to become clear. But yeah, it's really, really
So
hard to
I
explain.
find the sites that people are using passkeys with now are the sites that make it so easy to do that there really aren't any steps. Like there are sites or services, because there are apps and there's other things where there's simply a button that says, I want a passkey for this site instead of a password. And you press that button, and the next thing you know, your password manager is actually saying, oh, do you want to save this passkey and use it to log on to the site? It's like, yes, that is what I want to do. And you click that, and then that's it.
You're done.
You're done. You go to the site later, and then you kind of forget. And months later, if you want to really think about it, you'll notice, hey, I haven't entered a password or clicked a button to log into that site for a long time because the passkey's doing it for you.
Well, in theory, it's never that transparent, right? I mean, what you just described can be explained by just remember me. What I think is more interesting is that without remember me, then instead of being asked to enter your password or do jump through some other hoop, you're asked to unlock your device, right? You're asked to show your face or your fingerprint or enter your PIN. And it doesn't matter what site you're going to, all the pass keys are hidden behind that same device unlock.
I think the difference is, and I experience this with a lot of things that I log on to maybe once a month. You end up at the site or opening the app, and you have a screen saying you are logged out. You need to log in, and then the first step you do initiates the password manager, where then it does Face ID or key or whatever, and then it does all the rest for you. But you were like, I am logged out. What do I need to do? I think I click that log in. Oh, and then it's prompting me to do this. Whereas with pass keys, it's like one less step. The pass key's there. So anyway, I mean, it's not that pass keys are bad. Pass keys are good. They're very good. I mean, the passwords have a range is the thing. You could be using the same technology, a password to log onto a site, and person A could be doing it very insecurely by using a dictionary word, and it's the same one that they use for a whole bunch of sites. And person B, using the same tech, could be using a unique long password for that site. And the technology on the site's exactly the same no matter which one you choose. Passkeys don't have that option. You can't use a passkey poorly. You probably can. There's probably some way. But it's unlikely you're going to be able to use a passkey poorly. You can use a password poorly very easily.
The way to use a passkey poorly is to have poor security for your device.
Yeah, that's
So
true. And
if your unlock code for your phone is 1234, then that's not secure for any number of reasons, and indeed pass keys then fall into that same bucket.
But even I would say it's not as bad because still the vast majority of account break-ins are done remotely, right? They don't even know where you are, let alone have physical access to your device. And a weak password makes you vulnerable to millions of different people trying to break into your account all over the world. Whereas a weak pass key with a weak pass or not a pass keys are always strong, but a weak passcode on your phone only makes you susceptible to people that can physically take the device away from you. So it's bad. And I was in an argument with somebody this very week who insisted that they wanted no pass key, no passcode on their device. I'm never in a situation where somebody could take the device away from me. And I was like, this is really bad. And I was like, yeah, it's just, you don't want to do it. You don't want to do it. And I actually got to the point where if they had responded one more time in the debate, I was going to say, like, I wash my hands of this because I'm not going to tell you, advise you a way to weaken your security to that level. You're going to have to ask somebody else if
I
you want to
still
know
have
how to.
memories
remove
of
your
a
passport.
conference you and I went to many years ago
Oh
where,
yeah, I know what you're going to talk about. Yeah.
yeah, somebody basically asked everybody to hold up their phone
Yeah.
and chastised everybody who didn't have a lock code on their phone because it was
Yeah.
that that's a problem.
It, yeah, it's a problem, and I think it's even, I mean, even the whole idea of it's a computer and it's a desktop computer and it's in your house, and so, you know, I mean, there still are, a lot of people have safes in their house, and you could ask yourself, well, why do you even lock the safe? It's in your house. You know, somebody would have to break into your house to even open the door of the safe. Yet we still lock the safes. Why? Because somebody could break into the house. Somebody could break in and they could do it. I'm not talking about, you know, a guy in a mask with a crowbar. There are ways to social engineer yourself into the house too. Probably even more common. And so you put your document, your important documents in a safe, and you have a combo on it. Same thing with your computer, except your safe's probably hidden away somewhere. Your computer's probably sitting out there on display, easy for anybody to grab. And there's just too much important stuff on that computer to not have a passcode, to not spend the time to just enter in a short passcode that, since you're going to do it every day, you're going to be super fast at doing it. And then there are alternatives. Like I even suggested, it's like if you really want to do that, here's what you do. You can buy a keyboard from Apple. It's got Touch ID on it because they said they had an iMac. So I said, just get the Touch ID keyboard for your Mac. Now you won't have to enter your passcode very often at all. You just have this, you know, you put your finger there. There you go. There's your solution for your real problem, which is you don't want to be inconvenienced by the passcode. Anyway.
Face ID would be even less or even more convenient because there's almost nothing you have to do other than look at your device.
Yeah, well, they don't have that for Macs.
Well,
For
they
phones, of
are
course.
phones. Yeah,
No.
they do for phones.
Yeah,
Yeah.
for phones, no. For phones, it's ridiculous. Yeah, so it's an even more ridiculous argument to.
Supposedly, Face ID works on Windows too, although I've never done it myself. I think the real problem with Windows specifically is that there's so many different camera technologies that they're having to deal with.
Sure.
It's hard to So when it comes to pass keys,
Yeah.
the good news is that you if when it's properly set up, you don't have to have a password, period. What that means, of course, is that key loggers have nothing to log. Right. Phishing sites have nothing to phish. It basically is so good for protecting you from these kind of remote attacks. However, the question that I get probably the most often is, okay, great. I've set up a passkey on my account on my phone. I lose my phone. How do I get into my account? What a lot of people, it's, and I don't want to blame people because it is a difficult concept. It is a new concept that is on us to explain as best we can. But the bottom line is that there's always another way to sign in. Think about it. When you got that phone anew, when you got that phone for the first time, you didn't have a passkey on that phone for your account. How did you get the passkey on that phone? You logged in some other way. Now, that can be maybe they sent an email to an appropriate account with a code that you had to enter, or they texted you a code, or they did something else. None of it involving passwords, all of it somewhat less convenient, but they bootstrapped the process of authenticating who you are, at which point they could then say, okay, great, we've authenticated you. Hey, do you want to set up a passkey on this device? And you're done. You're back, right? Regardless of all of your other devices and all of your other authentication technologies. The other piece that I don't think gets enough press is when you lose your phone, if you have device-specific passkeys, in other words, if you are not using a password manager to keep passkeys the same, use the same passkey all across multiple devices. You have the opportunity to go to the service once you've signed in again successfully and say, you know what? Disable the passkey on my phone, the phone that I lost. so that even if somebody A has your phone, B breaks into your phone, and C tries to go to the account for which you have a password or a passkey, they can't because you remotely disabled the passkey. That's, I mean, there's so much goodness there. So to bring things a little full circle, I'm not going to try and read this on for the podcast, but I asked perplexity.ai to explain passkeys to me like I'm five. And it did a nice job. It's not going to be complete. And of course, when you're using simple technology, it's not going to be pedantically, absolutely on point, but it's a great little explainer. So I've got a link to that in the show notes. I went ahead and just posted it onto the Ask Leo Facebook page so that everybody could see it. It just, again, it's not that difficult a concept. It's just a different concept. And the for all of the articles that I've been writing lately on passkeys, I've basically been closing with, for one thing, this isn't going to happen quickly. Right. I mean, this is going to be a multi-year change. Think about how long it took two-factor to kick in. But it is coming, and it is more secure, even if you don't understand how it is more secure. Learn about it. Take the time to get comfortable with it. Maybe even experiment with it on an account you don't care about before you start using it on your primary accounts. And watch for folks like us to be continually trying to do a better job of explaining it in ways that make it not just understandable, but actually desirable.
Yeah, I think it would, it would help if the things were more consistent. That's the problem.
There's always that, but let's face it. I mean, again, that's why I think that's one of the reasons two-factor took a while too. Is there's so many different ways you could do two-factor, so many different interfaces, so many different times that it pops up. So, yeah, it's not like we've not been here before. We just know that because we've been here before, yeah, this is going to take a while.
Yeah.
If they're going to complain, let's us complain. Get off my lawn. So, one of the comments that I get frequently, and if in my case, it's a generic comment. Somebody will complain about something about Windows, for example. They'll say, such and such doesn't work the way it should work, and therefore all of Windows is crap. It actually has a name. I was looking this up when I was making notes for this. The fallacy of composition, assuming that something that is true of a part of a whole must also be true of the whole. So if this feature in Windows File Explorer annoys you, then all of Windows must be annoying. That's not how it works. Don't let little bugs, little issues get in the way of enjoying the whole thing behind them. That's, like I said, I find that incredibly frustrating when it comes across. Obviously, I generally don't express that frustration. That's what this segment is for. But yeah, it's definitely one of those things that comes up, and I'm sure you encounter it as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely all the time. Just picking out one specific little thing, like even with the new stuff, like the new stuff, macOS Sequoia, people saying that, such and such feature, these couple features aren't useful to them. So the entire thing's not useful to them.
Right.
And then I was like, well, there's all these other features. None of those are useful to you. And actually, that brings me to mine, which is just the basically, I'm glad we had this segment because I feel it's a little different that the main body of our podcast, we like to justify ourselves. We say, this is why I feel this way. And this is why, as a technology expert, this is blah, blah, blah. But I think here, we don't need to. We could just say, like, I'm bothered by Luddites, right? I see it especially during update time when the new operating systems come out. People saying they don't want to upgrade. They're going to stay with whatever it is they're using. And it bugs me. There's a reason why the motto for MacMost is get the most from your Mac. And that's when somebody says, how do I do something that like I get less from it, like not upgrading. I say, yeah, I can't really help you there. I'm all about getting the most from your Mac. If you want to get less from it, that's not me. Talk to somebody else, maybe. So,
Yeah. I'm glad we added this segment too. I find it very therapeutic. On the flip side, ain't it cool? So, one of the things we started watching, so I think I mentioned, maybe I didn't, I finally got around to reactivating my Apple TV subscription because we'd reached critical mass of the number of things we had pending on Apple TV. So, you know, we went through Foundation, went through a couple of other things that we've been waiting for. We started in on Silo. Silo, have you watched it?
I watched the, is it the second season that's out now or it's
It's
coming
the
out?
second season's just coming out. Yeah.
Okay, I watched the first season and I read the books.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
So my wife read the books apparently some time ago, but
Yeah,
I
me
haven't.
too.
I'm coming in this completely, completely clean. And I am really enjoying it. It seems to be well written, well paced. It's in kind of a, I want to say it's some new interesting concepts. But the other thing that I walked away with from the very first episode, is it's also got Fallout vibes, in the sense that, the Silo reminds me a lot of, how the folks in Fallout are surviving their nuclear catastrophe or their apocalypse. So anyway, I'm enjoying it. I'm looking forward to season two showing up on here, showing up on Apple TV, Silo. Did you watch Fallout, by the way? Okay.
Yeah, that was good. I like that. And yeah, very different views of the apocalypse.
Of course.
I liked I liked Fallout's more humorous sometimes view of things. And I also, and for Silo, one of the things I really liked about it that I was concerned about, because reading the books, there's a lot of character work in the books where it's not a traditional, here's the main character, it's almost first person with this main character, we're just going to go through
Right.
this. There are a lot of different characters, and it the books were like that, and then I was like, oh, they're going to change it for TV, and they don't, and they do a great job because they hire some great actors in the show, some really good top name actors that are in there that are do a great job of embodying these characters from the book, just like the book did it. So anyway. So that's so mine is actually a book, a new book. Sometimes I like to read fresh new sci-fi. I go back and forth between like really old sci-fi. Like I think I talked about a book from the 50s just a few months ago. And here's a book from this year called Some Desperate Glory by Emily Tesh. I really really enjoyed this pure sci-fi book about definitely the far future and Earth and other civilizations and how a pretty unique take on like a future that I really hadn't seen in other books. And it had a really enjoyable lead character too. So definitely check that out. It's getting a lot of attention, this book too, among those that like fresh new sci-fi.
I have to add it to my list of things to check out.
Yep.
In terms of, talking about ourselves, blatant self-promotion, the article I'd like to point people at this week is What's the Difference Between OneDrive, Google Drive, and Similar Services? It's askleo.com/174112. Obviously, I've done a lot of writing about OneDrive in recent months. Not only do I have a course on OneDrive, but I've written a number of articles because of some of the quirks and even bad decisions in the design of OneDrive. But the fact is, you don't have to use OneDrive. There's a lot of other alternatives to OneDrive. And in fact, even in the comments to the original article, I'm finding out a few more that I might end up looking into. On my machine specifically, I have OneDrive, I have Dropbox, I have Google Drive, I have Proton Drive, I have iCloud. And that's just me being me. But any one of those, they're all trying to sort of solve the same problem in with a little some differences around the edges and of course different pricing models and such. So anyway, I go through the major players and try and give some idea of exactly what is the difference between them all and which one might be right for you. AskLeo.com/174112. What's the difference between OneDrive and Google Drive and similar services?
Cool. I've of course been doing tons of videos on the new features of macOS and iOS for the new releases. So I'll point to one of those 15 new hidden features in iOS 18.
Cool. Well, we're back and good episode. So, as always, that does us for yet another week. We will hopefully be here again next week. I think we will be. As always, thanks for listening, folks, and we will see you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/teh231. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Bill, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.